Pleasure Nutritionist Daphne Cohn. Welcome to Sane, Slim, and Gorgeous, your game plan for looking hot, finding calm, and feeling fabulous.
This is our advanced session with Rick Hansen, a neuropsychologist. And Rick is going to take us through specific exercises and strategies for cultivating happiness, love, and wisdom in our life. Rick Hansen is, as I said, a neuropsychologist as well as a meditation teacher. He is also the author of numerous books, including his latest book, Buddha's Brain, The Practical Neuroscience of Happiness, Love, and Wisdom. Welcome back, Rick.
Thank you.
So we're going to just jump right on in here because there's a lot to cover, and it's really great to be able to do some of these exercises and start on this path of happiness, love, and wisdom. So let's start with happiness, since that's the first section that you take on in your book, Buddha's Brain. And maybe you can just briefly touch again on what the negativity bias is and then ways that we can start to shift out of that and really retrain our brain towards the positive.
Sure. Well, the foundation idea is that the brain has been shaped by literally 600 million years of evolution, especially the last 100 million or so. And it's built kind of like an ice cream cone from the bottom up in layers and then sort of expanding at the top. And so inside us right now is the leftover insect brain, reptile brain, or leftovers. What I mean by is what's left in evolution as evolution kept refining those things. We've got within us circuitry that is similar to the circuits inside literally a honeybee or a tuna fish, as well as layers that are similar to those within a crocodile or a gecko, and then coming up squirrels and rabbits and then monkeys and chimpanzees and then early humans and then modern humans. So it's a lot of layers in there. And they all work together. They're all really, really important. And but understanding that can kind of help explain in part what it's like to go through daily life, because sometimes it feels like the inner crocodile, you know, or the inner monkey is just totally hijacked, you know, the modern mind. And when we get upset about something or feel threatened about something. So on that long run, during evolution, we evolved in very, very hazardous and lethal environments, including in ones in which there were a lot of threats from people within our own primate bands, as we evolved as primates over about ballpark 80 million years or so. And therefore, the brain developed what scientists call a negativity bias. In other words, yes, our natural resting state is what I describe as the three C's, calm, contented, and caring. That's what we default to when we're not upset or in pain or hungry or threatened and so forth. But on the other hand, we can be driven from that home base, you know, at the crackle of a twig in the bushes nearby or by someone frowning at us across a room. And when that happens, whoop, you know, the brain goes into overdrive to keep us alive. And in evolution, it was important to pay attention to good news, sure. But if you missed some good news today, you probably have a chance of some good news tomorrow. In other words, if you missed a carrot, as it were, something rewarding, food or mating, as it were, today, well, you probably have another shot at it tomorrow. But if you did not miss something dangerous today, if you missed something dangerous today, in other words, if you failed to see a threat today, whap, no more chances at carrots tomorrow. And so as a result, the brain literally looks for negative information more than positive information. It reacts more to negative information, like someone frowning or you know, pressure, like a million emails coming at you, you've got to get done in an hour. And then it stores that negative information and then reacts to that negative information in a way that's unlike the way it operates with positive information. And as a result, even though most of our experiences day to day are neutral or positive, those just kind of flow through the brain like water through a sieve. But the ones that are negative, whack, it just grabs hold of, keeps, stores, retrieves, and then overreacts to. That's why I say the brain's like Velcro for negative experiences, but Teflon for positive ones. And so then, as a result, we, for example, a little detail, like studies have shown that in relationships, it takes usually about five positive interactions to make up for one negative one. In other words, a negative interaction is what I meant to say. You know, your partner's a little snarky with you or hassles you some. You know, it takes 5 positive interactions to just kind of neutralize that negative one. And so you got to ask yourself in your relationships, especially the intimate and important ones, you know, what's the ratio of positive interactions to negative ones? And if it tips much, you know, below 5-1 positive to negative, you know, that's a big warning sign. So that's an overall kind of explanation of the negativity bias. And in my book, I'm very interested in methods. I'm very, very, very interested in what regular people can do in the middle of regular lives to literally over time transform their own brain. And as they transform their own brain, guided by the understandings of modern science, turbocharged by the ancient insights of these contemplative practices where people trained the mind hard. You know, they're the Olympic athletes of mental training over thousands of years. Anyway, bringing it down to home, we can do things inside our head that will change our brain and therefore change our life. So for some examples here, one of the very first things I think that's useful for people is self-compassion. This is a hot area of research these days, and it's found that a lot of the value of self-esteem and self-confidence boils down to self-compassion. And self-compassion, first off, is not self-pity, and it's not wallowing in things and so forth, but what it is to bring to ourselves that quality of wishing that we be happy, wishing that we not suffer, and tender concern. So one way to neurologically warm up the circuits of self-compassion, which is interestingly and remarkably quite hard for many of us to do because we've internalized through the negativity bias so many critical messages, you know, over time. Even if our environment really wasn't that critical, those are the ones you remember, right? Isn't that true? You go through the day and life is really good, but you remember that one kind of put down that
Absolutely.
Happened at work. Yeah, that's the one we think about. So guess what? That's the one that goes into the brain. You know, as I think we said in the previous interview, there's a famous saying that neurons that fire together wire together. In other words, literally mental activity sculpts neural structure. So if a person is thinking about and, you know, attending to and having an emotional reaction to the one critical comment, right, that was made in an otherwise good day, the neurons involved in, you know, dwelling on that negative comment are all firing together. And guess what? Mechanically, deep down in the wiring of the brain, they're starting to link to each other and form, you know, an enduring trace that has a kind of negative emotional tinge to it. Any single time we do this, of course, doesn't make a huge difference unless it's really horrible or really extraordinary. But the slow accumulation, you know, bit by bit, Chinese water torture, drop by drop, you know, really changes the shape of the brain. So self-compassion, which is hard for a lot of people to do. A great way to warm up the circuits of that is first to recall the felt sense of being with someone who you know cares about you. It could be a pet. It could be someone no longer alive, like a really sweet grandparent. It could be your lover, your children, a spirit entity, God, whatever it is that gives you that feeling of being really, really loved. Second, move to a sense of awareness of another person that you really care about. So you start by feeling cared about yourself, and then second, you find someone else that you care about, naturally care about, like a child or children in general or someone you love or your pet or what have you. And then third step, move that same feeling of caring and goodwill, good wishes, to yourself. That's self-compassion. That's a really simple way to do it. So, you know, with the negativity bias, it's kind of natural to feel threatened, beleaguered, kind of outgunned by life. And that's just the natural inclination of the brain. And then added to that, we have life, including modern life, in which a lot of us, kind of me included, to be really honest, are on the receiving end of a fire hose of tasks. It reminds me of those Disney movies, you know, Mickey Mouse in the factory, where on the assembly line, everything's coming at him,
yeah.
And, you know, warp speed, and he's got to do it all now. And that's how life feels a lot. And then also, we are going, obviously, economically through a time of major change, and there is a fair amount of, you know, anger in the political culture these days, and then the world at large, you know, can seem alarming. And then, honestly, we get a ton of threat messages pulsed to us by the media, in part manipulatively, because that's one way to sell products, and it's also one way to get people to vote for strong, you know, strong authority figure leaders. And when that happens, we start feeling like our life is in threat level orange. So we walk around threat level orange everywhere we look. And the result of that is makes us feel kind of small or weak or just outnumbered or what, you know, and so forth. So therefore, it's a great practice to focus on feeling strong. And by that, I don't mean that we dominate other people or we bully others. It's just that we have that quality of inner strength. So here's a way to do it. First, recall a time when you felt really strong. And it might have been a physical activity. Like, I've done a lot of rock climbing, so I tend to go to those memories. And you don't even have to so much remember a situation. It's just to remember the feeling in your body or the attitude you had. A second thing a person can do to strengthen this sense of feeling strong is to literally move the body into the posture of inner strength. It's interesting that what we think of as pure thought or, you know, emotion is actually very intertwined with body sensations and physical motions and bodily postures. Lots of research on that these days. The fancy term for it is embodied cognition. So if you move your face, for example, into a smile, people in studies will rate cartoons as funnier. Whereas if they are forced to frown just mechanically by holding a pencil in a certain kind of way around their eyes, then they will rate sad pictures even sadder. So that's an example. So if you want to feel strong, sit up a little straighter, lift the chest up, head up. Kind of a traditional meditation instruction is stand like a king or queen, or, you know, like a spiritual teacher, you know, who has a quality of dignity. I think of people like Nelson Mandela, the Dalai Lama, people like that, that have a quality of boom, you know, they're present. And when we do that, that draws us into that feeling of strength. And then the last step, 1, 2, 3, a person can do to feel strong is to kind of bring to mind or call up a felt sense of their own capabilities. Again, we don't need to be Superman or Wonder Woman or Superwoman, but we have a sense that we do have determination. We have endured. If nothing else, we're still here. I will survive. And I have a good heart. I mean, I'm saying this. I mean, I do have a good heart. I know that. But other people have a good heart, too. People are saying to themselves, I have a good heart. I have a good mind. I'm determined. I'm not perfect. No halos here. But, you know, I'm okay. I can deal. And those three steps, 1, recall an experience of strength, 2, adopt the bodily posture of strength, 3, acknowledge the factual nature of inner capabilities. Those are three little things a person can do that will help them feel strong. And then, as we said in the last interview, whether it's self-compassion or feeling strong, take an extra 20 or 30 seconds once you're feeling it and let it sink in. That way, you'll get those neurons firing together. So those start wiring together. And gradually over time, you'll reverse the negativity bias and you'll increasingly make your brain like Velcro for positive experiences, but Teflon for negative ones.
That is great. Both of those exercises were excellent because I could feel the shift in my body as you were explaining them. And one thing I really like about the last one is, at the very least, just knowing I'm still here. That is enough to feel strong. We don't have to be, like you said, Superman or Wonder Woman. Just that we're here is a deep acknowledgement of how strong we are. Is this what you mean when you write, we can use the mind-body connections to lower our stress, cool the fires, and improve our long-term health?
Those are examples of that sort of thing. I think of those two as a little bit more preparatory. For example, stress management exercises, which I was alluding to in the quote you just read there. To even engage that, we've got to be on our own side. And we've got to be for ourselves, not against others, but for ourselves. And what I've learned is that for many people, it's actually very important to begin with self-compassion and accessing a sense of inner strength as the basis for getting on their own side, and then go to work on these other methods in the book for cooling the fires and developing much greater inner happiness, as well as increasing love and wisdom. So if you want, we can talk more about ways to cool the fires, so-called, and develop more of a kind of unconditional inner happiness that can't be shaken by, you know, the bumps and weirdnesses, you know, of modern life.
That would be great.
Can we do that?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Well, a little quick explanation here. You know, as we evolved, et cetera, we developed these two kind of primary systems to help us stay on an even keel. And they're called the sympathetic nervous system and parasympathetic nervous system. It sounds like they're separate nervous systems. They're not. They're just woven into the larger human nervous system. The sympathetic system is engaged with fight or flight. It's the stress response system. Now, it's also engaged with getting really excited because your team is finally in the playoffs or something like that. But it's also the system that gets engaged when we're upset about anything. It's interesting and important to appreciate that if we get anxious or mad, we're kicking into gear the exact same system that Mother Nature evolved to run away from tigers or to go to war with some other hunter-gatherer tribe. And so that's the sympathetic fight-or-flight system. The parasympathetic system balances it. The way that the brain and body work a lot is through these different systems that kind of balance each other for equilibrium, and this is another example of that. The parasympathetic is the rest and digest, quote-unquote, system. And the sympathetic system are connected like a seesaw. You know, when one goes up, it pushes the other one down. So if we want to bring down chronic sympathetic activation, which is the hallmark of modern life, you know, chronic low-grade stress, we evolved to handle acute, short-lived stress. We did not evolve to handle chronic low-grade stress, which is kind of the daily food, the bread and butter, as it were, of modern life. And so one of the results of that, of course, is a lot of increase in lifestyle illnesses that fundamentally are very linked to stress. For example, sympathetic arousal suppresses the immune system. It suppresses digestion, so people get constipation and ulcers. You know, when you suppress the immune system, you get colds and flus. It completely rattles the hormonal system, so women start cycling in different ways. Men have issues as well in terms of their hormonal system. And then it really rattles the cardiovascular system. It makes people more vulnerable to heart disease, and as well as the nervous system itself. And stress is a direct path to depression. So from doing my book and doing all the research involved in pulling it together was to really appreciate that stress is the enemy, in a sense. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a place for a little bit of stress, and some people temperamentally like a little bit of stress, like some people like a little bit of, you know, jalapeno pepper, right, in their salsa, and that's okay. Just a little, all right? You get much more than a little bit, you're going to hurt yourself. And so it's same as with chronic stress. So how can we get this parasympathetic activation? Get that system to jack up, to light up like a Christmas tree, to push down on that seesaw the sympathetic system so it doesn't lead us down the path of serious physical and mental health conditions. Well, a couple quick and easy ways, which I personally love because they're kind of cool and cute. One is to relax the tongue or yawn or touch the lips. And the reason is that parasympathetic nerve fibers innervate, that's the term, they go into massively the lips and the mouth because it's the digest wing of the nervous system. So right there in a busy meeting or dealing in a situation, no one needs to know that you're deliberately relaxing your mouth, relaxing your tongue, and maybe discreetly touching your lips. A second way to do it is to really focus on exhaling. People say take a big breath, that's fine, but when you inhale, you're actually activating the sympathetic wing of the nervous system a bit. When we inhale, the sympathetic nervous system handles inhalation, and it actually speeds up the heart rate a bit, whereas when we exhale, that's the parasympathetic handling that. So if, for example, a person in a tense situation or when they're upset focuses on, you know, inhaling and then a long, really relaxing exhale, while also maybe sensing that they're really letting go and relaxing in the body, and then doing that, you know, 3 or 5 times, I tell you, do it 10 times. It's really hard to still be upset. Or maybe, you know, on the 0 to 10 scale of how upset you can be, maybe a person started out at a 7. At the end of 5 or 10 long exhalations, you know, they're down around a 3, a 2, or a 1. So those are two good methods. That's a good method right there for dealing with stress in a regular way. Another wonderful method goes to our nature as enormously social and affiliating, joining, and loving creatures. And just to kind of explain this a bit, In evolution, we developed fundamentally three motivational systems. One is to approach the pleasant, the positive, the carrots, if you will. The second is to avoid the unpleasant, the sticks, the threats, the bad news of life. And the third system is to join with, to attach, to affiliate with us, quote unquote. And that's where mating and bonding is, raising children, having friends, feeling part of a group, being loyal to a group of people. That's that affiliation or attaching system. So we have these three systems. Interestingly, crocodiles and fish have the approach and avoid system, but only birds and mammals, and especially primates, and especially humans, have the attaching affiliating system. What the attaching and affiliating system does is it really calms stress, and it really reduces the sense of threat. So one way to help oneself relax as well is to connect with others. Also, it's to feel loving, or if you will, or kind, or positive about other people. That itself will activate the affiliating system and calm us down. And then as well, that self-compassion exercise where you bring up the sense of being with people, just reflecting on the people who like you, or the groups you actually are a part of, or recent experiences where people included you, or thought you were coming to lunch with them and they said, where were you? Or wanted to crawl into your lap, kind of hang out with you, or wanted to, you know, have you involved in their work group. Anyway, all of those are different ways to activate the circuits of the affiliating attaching system, which will then help control feeling stressed and then draw us more into calm well-being.
Great. Now, one of these aspects, the social aspect, really brings us into this next section of the book of love, because so much, of course, of being social is the ability to share love. So can you talk to us a little bit about the importance of loving kindness, what that means, and how that helps promote health, and what we can do to foster more loving kindness in our life?
That's a great question, and it actually gets at a very new and interesting area of research, which is how relationships, and especially loving ones, and the experience of being caring and kind and compassionate for others actually has significant physical and mental health benefits. You know, it was long thought that the mind and the body were separate, but part of the new understanding of the mind-body connection is how it's a two-way street. Just like getting sick can feel depressing a little bit. One of the first symptoms that a person's getting a cold or a flu is their mood starts to drop. It goes the other way too, that as we experience being open-hearted and loving and caring, that does all kinds of wonderful things for cardiovascular health, hormonal regulation, gastrointestinal function, and all the rest of that. So how to do it? Well, first, let's be clear here. When we talk about being kind and caring, we don't mean being a doormat or letting other people walk all over you. I mean, one of the chapters actually in the book, for me, is a very important one. I think it's called Compassion and Assertiveness. In other words, the two go together. Interestingly, feeling strong and feeling like you have your own boundaries and feeling like you can take care of yourself in your important relationships, paradoxically, lets you relax and open and connect to other people without feeling overrun by them. You know, it goes to the Robert Frost line that fences make for good neighbors. So I think it's great to start with preparatory kind of practices like inner strength, the one I talked about earlier. That's a good beginning. Another is to bring to mind a very clear and felt sense of boundaries, literally like a kind of fence. Honestly, if I'm in some weird situations, when I was a kid, I was a sci-fi nut, I'll hear the Captain Kirk's voice in my head, shields up, Scotty, you know, because those shields are going to paradoxically let me stay more present with what's really going down here. I'll also visualize myself or sense myself as a big oak tree with roots going deep into the ground. I love trees. I love the outdoors and all that stuff. And what's happening is like wind whistling through the tree. Yeah, it's windy. Let's say someone's mad or there's some weird situation going on or there's an upset here that's kind of unclear or what's up, you know, and the wind is whistling through the trees and, yeah, the leaves are jiggling and the twigs are moving around, but fundamentally the tree is standing here. One doesn't need to resist what's coming through. It just comes through, but there's still that sense of deep rootedness and strength. So those are different ways to access a felt sense of boundaries with other people. Another thing to do is to say little things in your mind, like, I don't have to agree, or I'll get my turn later, or that's not my problem. You know, it's like the sign in the gas station or something, or at work, you know, your lack of planning does not constitute my
right.
emergency. Little sayings inside your own head, or one thing I do with other people that is actually a very effective way to not feel so pushed by them, is to find compassion for them, is to find the sense inside myself, even if I don't agree with them, even if I'm kind of mad at them myself, and even if I don't approve of what they've done, to wish that they not suffer, to wish that they be truly happy, which is actually kind of enlightened interest, because honestly, people are less likely to be jerks toward us if they feel happy. People usually are jerks because they're unhappy in some way. They're upset about something, they're mad, they feel beleaguered themselves, they feel threatened, what have you. So, compassion. The last thing is, I'll reflect on what I think of as the 10,000 causes upstream of that person that are pulling their strings, pushing them around, jostling them, and leading them to act in this way today. You know, they're having a bad day, and I'm bumping into their bad day, right? And I don't like bumping into their bad day, but if I understand better what's going on with them, then I don't feel so pushed. The last thing I'll say in passing is another method. It's for me a very, very important one that is foundational to creating the causes and conditions that lead to a loving, happy, appropriately scaled, you know, sense of connection with other people, closeness, even intimacy. And that is, honestly, to take maximum, reasonable, personal responsibility for whatever's gone wrong here. I think that's actually critically useful. In other words, the natural tendency, of course, is if someone is upset with us or complaining about us or criticizing us or pushing us to do something differently, the natural tendency, of course, is to lean away from them and to kind of get away from the situation, right?
Right.
That's pretty human nature. You know, the Dr. Phil question, how's that working for you? In other words, when we back away from or resist the grievance, if you will, the issue, the need, the complaint, the upset of the other person, it doesn't help. It makes them more upset. They get louder because they want to get us to hear it, blah, blah. What works better, honestly, is to unilaterally, in one's own mind, identify what there is to correct legitimately and to take maximum reasonable is a key word here, maximum reasonable personal responsibility for that, and then implement a correction unilaterally. Take the high road, in other words. Focus on what I can do about my part in this problem and just do it. Even if the other person continues to be kind of a jerk or whatever, or they just don't do their part. You know, they're not a jerk, but they just don't do their part. At least if we do our part, one, we're going to feel good. Two, it's what we can do ourselves. So suddenly we're a hammer instead of a nail. You know, we've got a sense of efficacy here. We're a cause. We're an agent. That's important for mental health because helplessness is deeply undermining of well-being and is a fast track to depression. Another thing is that it's the best odd strategy for eliciting good behavior from the other person. Mm. If you want someone to treat you well, treat them well. For me, those are all very foundationally important methods and practices for achieving closeness with other people. And then, if you want, I can talk about the three neural circuits of empathy.
I do. I have a quick question before we go there.
Yeah, great.
Which is, personal responsibility is so intimately connected to creating healthy boundaries in my mind. So can you just say a little more about how to create healthy versus unhealthy boundaries? Say someone comes up to me and they're behaving in a way that I feel is really hurtful. And I want to be present for them. But if I'm present in one way, I could just end up feeling honestly like crap at the end of the situation. But if I can have healthy boundaries, then I can see myself being present for them without losing myself to whatever's going on. Like maybe, as you said, they're just having a bad day. So how to be present for another person and take care of myself at the same time?
That's a great question. And several things to me are really key and useful here. One, clarify in your own mind almost like a code of conduct, like whatever you think is sort of appropriate. And that varies a little. Like, for example, I lived in Germany for a year, and ordinary people would just start yelling at each other in a in a cleaner's, and like in a way that would be, I grew up in California, really weird, you know, in California. And yet culturally, that's just what they did there. And then people would kind of calm down, you know. We were in Italy recently, and people speak in a very heated way about fairly minor matters, and it doesn't mean anything, you know what I mean? Like, there's not enough butter, and the guy starts waving his hands at the restaurant, and the waiter starts waving his hands too. And in America, if they were doing that, you'd think, oh my God, someone's going to pull out a gun in the moment here. You know, culture really, really varies. That said, for example, I think obviously any threat or actuality of violence, dead stop right there, you know, totally inappropriate, absolutely uncalled for. Usually the person on the receiving end of that is female. Occasionally it's male. It's actually more common than people think, and it's really important to just have zero tolerance. Think of it as green, yellow, orange, and red. So any whiff of that is a red light. You know, people start raging at us. I think that's a red light. That's uncalled for. It's inappropriate. It's one thing for the other person to get heated, to be kind of mad. For me, it's important to have a kind of spaciousness around that. But to start raging uncontrollably, or third red light, really demeaning, vile language, that's just completely uncalled for. By the way, these are standards that go both ways. So if we walk our talk, it's a lot easier to ask people to do the same. So I think that's step one, kind of clarifying the mind. My bottom line, honestly, is what would Miss Manners say? What would Dear Abby say? What would the Reader's Digest say in terms of how people could reasonably conduct themselves with each other? Okay, so that's one, clarifying what's okay and what's not okay, what's in bounds, what's out of bounds. And then second, I think it's useful offline in an ongoing relationship to negotiate, you know, how we're going to talk to each other. In other words, we got to be able to talk about how we talk with each other. And interestingly, that's often a taboo. Often people who are verbally abusive try to punish others for commenting on the verbal abuse. So one of the first things to do is to establish that it's okay to talk about talking. And sometimes what works in an ongoing relationship is to go out to dinner in a neutral setting. People tend to behave better in restaurants than they do in their own living room sometimes. And so, you know, just kind of, hey, what are we going to do? Are we going to yell at each other? Or are we going to call each other certain kinds of names? Are we going to swear at each other? I hope not. And then establish some kind of ground rules. The second thing, besides kind of establishing and knowing in your mind what's cool and what's not cool, which includes how long, like, you know, people get mad for a while. I don't know. People vary on their notion of that. 5, 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
I'm okay with that. But if someone's been mad at me or just kind of really in their thing for much past 10 minutes, I'm starting to think, you know, honestly, it's time to move on. Not like it's time to just get over your anger, but I mean, it's time to shift into something more productive here.
Mm-hmm.
A healthy fight has a trajectory, sort of like throwing a ball to somebody. You throw it high in the air, it arcs up, and then it kind of comes back down to earth again. A good fight looks like that. In other words, it ramps up, it gets intense, it's kind of messy, it's not perfect, we're not, you know, we're animals, we're not perfect. But then, after 5 or 10 minutes, or even just a few minutes, at least one person is starting to focus on, okay, how are we going to solve this problem, make amends for what's important to heal and make amends about, put correction in for the future, and move on. How are we going to start focusing on the future? Most fights are about the past. I'm a really experienced couples counselor. I've seen it myself. It's really hard to productively fight about the past. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Occasionally, you really need to talk through something that happened. But what's most effective is to come to agreement about how you're going to operate from now on and then really stick to it. All right, so that's kind of all the first thing. The second thing about this boundaries question that I've seen is really useful is to, keyword, unilaterally, you get to decide in your own mind what is legitimate and what is not so legitimate or valid, really, in what the other person is bringing to you. In other words, in your own mind, did you commit a misdemeanor or a felony? Or honestly, was it truly a nothing? And they've just got their knickers in a twist about nothing at all. Now, you get to decide that. And what I find works effectively when someone is kind of spewing for a while is to really try to get at, in a very sincere way, what really bothered them or what they wanted that didn't happen, and to get beneath the anger. In other words, if in a sincere way we do the opposite of our natural inclination, which is to back out, but we actually lean in and we sincerely want to understand what we did that was a problem for that person and why it was a problem and what we could do in the future that's reasonable, keyword reasonable, that would prevent that problem for them from ever happening again. My experience is most people calm down quickly.
Yeah.
Honestly. Most people are blown away that without being a doormat, I'm not waiving my rights, I got my shields up, you know what I mean? I am the mighty oak tree. But I'm also really leaning in and trying to understand what happened here. What was really upsetting? And then, in other words, you get beneath the anger to something softer.
Yeah.
And it encourages that softening and opening in that other person where they're going to acknowledge that they were frightened by something. Something made them anxious. Or they felt devalued. They felt belittled. They felt like they didn't matter to me or something like that happened. Or they were sad about something. Or honestly, something got stirred up in them from previous years or often going all the way back into childhood that was like a preamp that took what I did, let's say, which was maybe on the 0 to 10 scale of, you know, misdeeds, was like a 2. All right, you're right, I was 20 minutes late for dinner. That's a 2 on the 0 to 10 scale. It's not an 8. But it hit the turbocharge for them that, let's say, their dad was always late for dinner and it was a huge upset in their family. And so suddenly it feels inside them like a 6 or a 7. Right? When we really try to inquire at a deeper level, not playing therapist and not trying to mind read others, that's really annoying, you know what I mean? Not doing that, but sincere, you know, gentle and sincere, down to earth, feet on the ground, interest. And that's where strength comes in, that we have the strength to actually find out what happened inside that person and how we hurt them or how we upset them or how, honestly, what we did was a 0 or a 2 or a 1 on the misdeed scale, and they're just way overreacting. Okay, and then what we do is we sort out. We say, well, look, I got it, so I'm really going to make an incredible effort to get home on time from now on, and I can now really understand how this just was very upsetting for you. I apologize for that. That said, honestly, you know, I just don't want to get yelled at for 10 minutes in the way you were yelling at me when I'm 15 minutes late for dinner. That's kind of a separate thing. The two are separate. From now on, I am really, really, really going to get on top of this coming home late thing, which I got to admit I've been doing more lately than previously. But on the other hand, I want to have kind of an understanding between us that we just don't yell at each other the way you yelled at me. Can we agree on both things? That I'm going to get home in time for dinner, and I'm not going to yell at you, and you're not going to yell at me the way that happened here. You see how I'm talking here?
Yeah.
It's important to sort these out. Very often what happens is people mush this stuff together. Honestly, sometimes, just as a skill point, it's useful to just focus on what you're going to do differently in the future, and then later, when the person is calmer, and maybe after you've come home on time a couple days in a row, you then bring up about how they talk to you.
Yeah.
The problem is sometimes if you move back and forth too fast between their issue with you and then, whoop, you're getting into your issue with them, it almost feels weird, or it's kind of like turnabout or getting back at them. And that's where inner strength comes in, and inner patience and inner compassion, and coming on, being on your own side. It helps you be patient and to realize that you're going to have a lot of at-bats here, a lot of innings with this person, and play the long game to win. You know, sometimes lose a battle to win a war.
That's great. I really like the question, what they wanted that didn't happen, because it just allows you to get to the root of it in a very open-hearted approach to the situation.
Yeah. So that's great. Another way to ask that same question is essentially, you know, what do you want to have happen differently in the future,
mm-hmm,
from now on? Or what would have happened that would have not made you upset? In other words, how could I have acted in a way that would have been okay with you?
Right.
Those
right.
are all the same ways of asking the same question.
Excellent.
That's great. Yeah.
So as we are asking these questions, it really helps to have empathy. So if you want to go back to developing empathy, that would be great.
Sure. Empathy is actually really useful because in the frame of what we were just talking about, it helps you understand what in the world is going on inside the black box of the other person's mind, right? In other words, how could it be so upsetting that I was 15 minutes late? Or why was it so upsetting that I was chatting with this other man or other woman at the party and you got so jealous about that? I don't get it. You know what I mean? So it's very useful. Plus, empathy is very useful in the workplace. It helps us understand our coworkers better. It helps us tune into our boss. It educates us about what their hot buttons are. You know, people have what I call imperatives, these things that for them are just fundamentally important. To generalize and to give an example, typically men tend to have a big imperative around autonomy and not being dominated, whereas women tend to have a big imperative around joining and feeling included. So in a relationship situation, even in a work environment, if a guy starts to feel that suddenly he's being pushed around or dominated or talked down to, then suddenly respect becomes the imperative that's running in his mind. And it's not that women are not this way as well, but it does tend to load somewhat on gender. Whereas if women feel, particularly in an intimate relationship, that the guy is not really with them, that they're not together, you know, then suddenly, whoa, that becomes the important thing to deal with, rather than the content of the original fight, which is how to load the dishwasher. So empathy lets us understand what the imperatives are and the needs in other people so we can work things out in a way that is win-win for everybody. And, of course, understanding others is a way to understand ourselves as well. So, interestingly, in evolution, to become the most empathic animal on the planet by far, human beings, we develop these three fundamental circuits of empathy in which essentially we simulate the inner world of the other person. We resonate with them so that we develop a sensing inside of something of what it's like to be them. One system simulates the actions of others. That's the so-called mirror neurons or mirror circuits, where we're basically activating some of the same neurons inside ourselves that engage a motor act when we see another person doing that same motor act. In other words, if I reach for a cup, if I reach for a cup, let's say 1,000 neurons light up inside my head in my sensory motor circuits. If I watch you reach for a cup, 100 of the same neurons light up inside my head that also light up when I'm reaching for a cup. Hmm. You see how that is?
Yeah.
So suddenly I'm getting a feeling inside my own body of cup reaching, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm getting a kind of an echo, a whiff, if you will, of what it's like to be you reaching for a cup. And then we have similar systems, or they do the similar thing for tracking the emotions of other people or simulating the emotions of other people and also simulating the kind of thoughts and psychodynamics and personality swirling of other people. The mirror neuron circuits are more in the temporal parietal junction. It's a part of the brain kind of in the side and the back. The circuits that track emotions in others are in the insula, which is a part of the brain kind of in the inside that also senses the internal state of one's own body. And then these circuits that activate when we're being empathic with the thoughts and desires and memories and kind of personality dynamics of the other person are in the prefrontal cortex right behind the forehead. So one way to strengthen empathy circuits in something I just alluded to in that the same part of the brain that tracks the internal physical sensations of the body senses the emotions in other people. So, as I said earlier, neurons that fire together wire together. When you stimulate a part of the brain through mental activity, you also start strengthening that part of the brain, including for other functions. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
So, for example, if you strengthen the insula, and studies have shown that it literally becomes measurably thicker because new synapses form, those little junctions between neurons, and also there's increased blood flow to regions that are routinely active. So if you strengthen the insula, including making it measurably thicker, by tuning into your own body sensations routinely, like through, you know, meditation or prayer or yoga or dance or just walking the dog while really feeling your body sensations, you will then increase the capacity to sense your own body sensations. But interestingly, you'll increase the capacity to sense and tune into the inner world of other people.
Wow.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
a very powerful method, just right there, just sensing your own body sensations. Or honestly, you know, a lot of people would wish their partner was more empathic.
Yeah.
Statistically, it's more often that women wish men were more empathic. And if you want your partner to be more empathic, one way to do it is to really encourage him or her to pay more attention, particularly in a kind of a routine way. You know, little things add up a lot over time. Pay more attention to the internal sensations in his or her body.
Rick, I want to interject for just 1 minute because we have a couple different people speaking in the area of relationships on this series. Mm-hmm. And one thing just to point out is that a lot of times women tend to say that their male partners are not as empathic as they would like them to be. And sometimes it's just a matter of understanding the differences between men and women, that a man may actually be empathic, he just may express it differently. And so we don't perceive them as being the way we would like them to be.
I couldn't agree more. And one of my favorite books of all time is You Just Don't Understand.
Yes.
By Deborah Cannon, which talks about gender differences in communication. The other thing I would say that for me has been very helpful is to appreciate, which goes back to our notion of boundaries, you know, and fences make for good neighbors, that very often people who seem disconnected and not empathic are actually so flooded by interpersonal stimuli. They're so flooded by the feelings of others, and in a sense, they care so much about other people that because they're flooded, they back away to dial down the overwhelming amount of stimulation that's coming in. In other words, they move to a kind of optimal distance, so they're not so flooded by what's coming at them. And I think that's the case, actually, for many men I've worked with in couples. The bottom line is, when they really open up to connectedness with their partner, they love her so much, and she's so important to them, that it just kills them
right.
when she's at all upset or bothered by something, including not even about them. That's
right.
why men often rush into this problem-solving mode. They're just so overwhelmed by the ups and downs, the roller coaster of this person they care about, that they just want to make it go better fast,
yeah.
you know, or get better fast. So exactly true.
Yeah. I didn't mean to take us off on a tangent. I just felt like that was an important point.
I think it's a very important point. Obviously, there are a lot of cases where the patterns are reversed. I've seen that a lot, actually, where the woman is, in fact, kind of cerebral, you know, fairly cool and kind of distancing and gets uncomfortable with closeness. And it's the guy who's sitting across the room. He's only 2 feet away or 3 or 4 feet away in my office, but it's like he's on the other side of the Grand Canyon, you know, reaching his hand across to her. She won't come join him. So, you know, it can go both ways.
Right, absolutely.
Also, one way to be more empathic, that's also very powerful, is to sustain eye contact. And not to do it in a kind of new age stare, like, you know, that's obnoxious. People do that. But, you know, and sometimes you got to look away to actually, you know, fences make for good neighbors, right? You got to look away a bit to then come back to the eye contact. But watching the face, they're actually dedicated neural systems that are engaged with facial expressions that are universal across the human species, whether it's a Stone Age headhunter in Borneo or some sophisticated stockbroker in Manhattan. The same facial expressions manifest in these primary emotions, especially of disgust or fear or anger or surprise or joy or love. And if we watch the face closely of our partner, particularly around the eyes, suddenly there's a very intense stream of information coming into our own brains that are helping us resonate better with them. So that's another good method, too, for empathy.
Great. So as we cultivate more compassion for ourselves and get on our own side and create healthy boundaries and nurture empathy, then the next step to really living with more happiness, love, and wisdom is, as you say, not taking things personally, which is huge. I can't even imagine living and not taking things personally. But if you could share with us some of the ways to do that, that would be great.
Yeah. Well, we're now in the deep end of the pool here. And first, this topic of what is the self or what is the I, you know, who am I, is a profound topic. I mean, there you are late at night under the stars or maybe in the teen years very pointedly. We ask, you know, who am I? And it's a question that has a lot of religious and spiritual overtones as well as deep philosophical overtones. Interestingly, modern science is starting to actually give us some very powerful and amazing information about that question. And it's honestly, it's kind of disorienting because the ordinary notion, right, is that I'm me and you're you, right? You know, that's it. That's just the way it is. The conventional notion is that there is deep down inside us a subject, quote-unquote, an I, a me, that is the unified, non-dividable, stable, and independent owner of experiences and agent of actions. It's kind of the classic idea. That's fancy language, but it really boils down to how we experience it. First of all, let's make a distinction between the I and the person, or between the self and the person. There's no doubt that there are persons here. There's no doubt that your body is different from my body, that my personhood is different from your personhood. There are different set of memories associated with this body-mind over time, different personality tendencies. Persons have moral standing. We have duties to persons, and persons have moral responsibility. You know, they're culpable for their actions. Okay. But in direct experience, people can observe that these sort of, you could say, three defining characteristics of selfhood. In other words, that it's unified, that it's stable, and that it's independent, are actually not to be found. Because what you notice, first of all, is that the self is very, there are a lot of selves. As Walt Whitman said, I am multitudes. In other words, the person that set the alarm at night to exercise in the morning is very different from the person who hears the buzzer go off at 6 a.m. and goes, who set the damn clock? You know what I mean? So they're very different. You can just tell, you know, when you're with some people, you're kind of one kind of way. When you're with other people, you're a different kind of way. Right. The self you are when you're, you know, holding your baby in your arms is very different from the self you are when you're banging through a million emails fast. You know, there's a lot of variability. You know, we have a lot of parts to us. And then second, those parts vary, as I was saying. They change. They're not stable over time. They're very transient. And the third is that we're not independent. Who we are moment to moment is very affected by our circumstances and fundamentally is affected by our own life history and even evolution, because the human self or sense of self is very different from that within our closest animal relatives, the chimpanzees. So that's our experience, but it's also true in the brain. That's what's so amazing. In the brain, self functions and self activation is spread out through the entire brain. There's no place in the brain where I live. There's the sense that there's an eye looking out through at the world through the eyes or listening to the world through the ears. But actually in the brain itself, as different kinds of selfing occur, way different neural circuits are lighting up all over the place. So we're not unified in the brain. We're actually widely distributed in the networks, in the neural nets of the brain. Second, we're not stable over time. We're not enduring. Those circuits in the brain are constantly changing. They're lighting up like a Christmas tree or the aurora borealis and constantly changing, constantly moving around. They're transient. Self is transient inside the brain. And then last, self is certainly not independent in the brain. Those circuits that light up that correspond to different aspects of I or me or mine, you know, or different experiences of I, me, or mine, are very influenced by what's happening around them. So what we start having then, through hardcore, amazingly well-done research studies, is it starts to look more like the view of the self that, frankly, is more of an Eastern tradition, an Eastern view of I that's distinct from the Western tradition. It looks increasingly like the Western European and, you know, kind of North American tradition going back to the Greeks and so forth, that there's a unified, coherent owner of experiences is just not true. That understanding, which may sound kind of philosophical though, can actually take a person to lightening up some and to feeling more connected with things in general and therefore less identified with particular views or a particular body or particular positions. Yes, take care of your property. Make sure your money's in a safe place. You know, repair that fence and keep your neighbor's dogs off your lawn if you want to. That's all cool. Take care of your own health. You know, treat yourself with respect. But understand that what we are really is much more like a standing wave. You know, as a stream flows over a boulder, the wave that forms as the stream passes over that boulder does have some stability and continuity over time, but it is constantly changing its shape, right?
Right.
And also what's flowing through it is constantly changing as well. We are standing streaming, as it were. We're like a standing wave. So one way into an experience of that is to observe, just in direct experience, that the sense of self is constantly changing. And very often it's not even present. like reaching for the salt shaker or turning one's head or just kind of relaxing and hanging out with others, there's very often not much sense of self at all. And by observing that and getting comfortable with that, that's a way to take things much, you know, less personally. Another way is to truly appreciate how, you know, of the 10,000 causes that are moving through our life at any moment in time, maybe 50 or 100 are under our own control, right?
Mm, right.
We are so affected and shaped. In the Buddhist language, we codependently arise with all things. That also is a way to relax. You know, I just feel, I mean, I want to tend to the causes of what I can tend to, right? I want to water the fruit tree as best I can. But whether or not the tree, which means my life, bears fruit, is really pretty much out of my hands.
Mm.
In other words, I can tend to the causes, but I can't control the results.
Mm.
And that's another way into this felt sense of not taking things so personally. The last thing I'll say about this, maybe about not taking things personally, is in relationships. This kind of a wonderful parable, which I update in the book, goes like this. Imagine that you go for a picnic on a slow-moving river, and it's Sunday, it's summertime, it's nice, everything's great, you get all dressed up, you're with your friend there, got your picnic basket, grandma's, you know, heirloom silver, and it's all wonderful. And suddenly, bang, there's a big loud thump on your canoe. You're in a nice canoe, and it tips over and dumps you in the river. Yuck, right? You come up sputtering, your hair's wet, your clothes are ruined, this dress, grandma's silver's at the bottom of the river, irretrievable, it's gone, and what do you see? You see two teenage boys with snorkels have snuck up on your canoe and dumped you in the river, and they're laughing about it. How do you feel?
Are you asking me to answer that?
Or anybody. Pretty mad, right?
Because I can
I'd
answer.
Be per- yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So how would you would? Yeah, you wouldn't like it, would you?
I would, yeah, I would be pretty upset, and I would probably also be embarrassed, and so I would be a combination of different things. But
yeah,
upset.
It might be a sense of, why are you picking on me, you guys?
Yeah.
You know? Okay. Now, imagine the same story. Everything's the same. River, Sunday, picnic, friend, dressed up, done your hair up, neat food, grandma's silver. And then the same thing happens. Loud thump, boom. Canoe tips over, you're dumped in the river. Grandma silver's at the bottom of the river. Your clothes are ruined. You come up sputtering. You're kind of shocked. And what do you see this time? You see a large submerged log has drifted downstream and smacked into your canoe and tipped you into the river. Now, how do you feel? Particularly different from how you'd feel compared to if it was two teenage boys that had dumped you into the river.
Yeah, I wouldn't be in this place of blame, and I certainly wouldn't have the shame that I, or not shame necessarily, but embarrassed about being tipped over by two teenage boys. And, yeah, it would be a very different feeling.
Isn't that interesting? You wouldn't take it personally. In other words, it's a bad event. It's a bummer. But you wouldn't add a whole bunch of other reactions to it. Buddha had a nice metaphor for that. He called it the first and the second dart. In other words, in life, there are a lot of first darts. The ultimate first darts are old age, disease, and death, and the loss of loved ones. Those are the ultimate first darts, and unavoidable, you know, physical pain. But then we add all these second darts to them. So in the parable of the canoe here, the first dart is getting dumped into the river. For sure, that's a drag. And in life, we should try to avoid first darts as best we can. But we don't need to add insult to injury by getting all, you know, upset about them. We add a proportion to what happened. And the thing to realize is that most other people, when they're doing their thing at us or around us or toward us, honestly, they're like logs. We're just in the way of their bad day. And, yeah, we should get away from logs or do damage control once they smack into us. And, you know, sometimes we need to get in a different river, right?
Right.
We need to disengage from that person or shrink the size of the relationship to the scale that makes it safe or to enlist other resources to help accomplish that, like family and friends, maybe a, you know, rabbi, minister, what have you, or a therapist, or really step back big time from the relationship. But fundamentally, most other people are like logs. So I try to keep that in mind, actually, when I'm on the receiving end of somebody's bad day, as it were, or just bad life, you know, or the 10,000 causes upstream of them. They're kind of like a log, you know. And, yeah, I want to negotiate with them, acting better toward me in the future. And yeah, I want to really understand what's going on inside that black box between your ears that led you to act this way on this day. But out of self-protection, out of self-respect, I don't want to take it so personally. I want to figure out what my responsibility was in the matter so I can act differently in the future and also give them what they need from me so they're not so cranky with me. But other than that, you know, I want to move on with my life and not keep dwelling on this sense of victimization or mistreatment way out of proportion to what's useful.
Great. That's great, Rick. I really appreciate all the information and the tools and the techniques that you gave us on this call to essentially show up and be more present in our life as a way to retrain the brain and therefore cultivate more happiness, love, and wisdom in our daily life. So thank you so much.
Oh, I really appreciate that. And honestly, if I could say this, if people want more resources, I on my website offer a lot of free resources. They can also learn more about my book and other writings and programs I do. And if they just go BuddhistBrain.com, that'll take them to my website. And, you know, the stuff there is basically freely offered. I'm really into that piece of this all, you know, just kind of offering resources out into the world. So BuddhistBrain.com will take people to that resource, you know, center, if they will.
Wonderful. And it's a fantastic book for anyone interested in reading it and learning more about the brain, but also strategies and tools for awakening more happiness, love, and wisdom in our life. So
excellent.
Thank you, Rick.